In this episode, we talk about six things I'm doing financially that on the surface don't make any sense. Let's get started. Let's get
some money. From New Money, New Problems, it's the New Money, New Problems podcast, a show for successful professionals searching for the tools they need to navigate financial opportunities and obstacles they've never seen. Negotiating compensation, purchasing your first investment property, helping your family with money, the highs and lows of entrepreneurship. New money brings new problems that require new solutions. Join us as we work through them together. I'm Brenton Harrison, and this is the New Money, New Problems podcast.
Hello, my name is Brenton Harrison of New Money, New Problems, and your host for the New Money, New Problems podcast. I hope you guys had a good 4th of July holiday. I'm going to share at the end of this episode why we decided to do a new episode today instead of doing a replay of one that we've released in the past. But suffice it to say, when I was thinking about what to talk about this week, I am operating under the assumption that if you're like me, financial literacy is not the biggest thing on your mind the Friday after a July 4th holiday. So I want to keep this episode a little high level, but I did want to give you something this week. And as I shared at the end of this episode, I will tell you why. So what I'd like to share with you are six things that I'm doing financially, or my family is doing financially, that we've decided are the best moves based on the knowledge we have in front of us at this point in time, that if you look at what people tell you to do in terms of financial literacy, they're not the quote unquote correct things. And I want to start with the first thing that we do that we didn't have to do that may not make sense on paper, and that is choosing to pay PMI on our mortgage when we don't necessarily have to. If you are not aware, PMI stands for private mortgage insurance, and it's something that when you have to pay for it, you are paying to protect your lender from the likelihood that you default on your mortgage. I know that seems counterintuitive, where you're paying so that you can further protect them, but the concept behind it is if you do not put a large enough down payment on your property, then the risk of you defaulting on your mortgage are higher, and PMI is something that you have to pay for until you have at least 20% equity in your home compared to its market value, and before that point, PMI is required to be added onto your payment. Now, the way that you avoid PMI is pretty obvious. You can put a down payment on your home of at least 20%. And that's something that I often see people do when they're trying to get into a home, because if you grew up like I grew up, when you're hearing about how you buy a home, one of the things they tell you is, oh, you should never have PMI on your home mortgage if you can avoid it. It's kind of like people saying that you should never lease a car, you should always own a car, which is another piece of outdated financial advice, which we'll talk about in later episodes. But when we were leaving our condo and deciding to buy a bigger home for our family, we fortunately had enough equity in our condo where we could have put 20% down on our home loan. But if we decided to put 20% down, we would have immediately been house poor, where we wouldn't have had enough emergency funds. We wouldn't have been able to do some of the projects that we wanted to do around the house to just make it more of a home that we feel like we could stay in for the next 15 to 20 years. But the biggest thing is the extra equity that we had in our home represented an opportunity to invest some of those funds as well. In our case, we only had to put 10% down, but because we didn't meet the 20% down payment requirement, it would have meant, and it did mean, having PMI on our home loan. But there's two misconceptions, in my opinion, about how PMI works in the first place. The first misconception is that if you are not using a first-time home buyer loan, that you have to put down 20%. That may actually be the case when you talk about investment properties, but with your primary home, as I said, you may come across mortgages where even though you're not eligible for the 3.5%, you can do something like 10% as the minimum down payment. The second misconception is that PMI has to cost an arm and a leg. And that misconception comes because most people don't realize that if you have strong credit, in many situations, the PMI that you pay on your home mortgage will be not inconsequential, but much lower than most people think. You're looking at an article on screen, which we'll share in the show notes if you're listening, from NerdWallet. This is a PMI calculator, and it says, how much is your mortgage insurance? Now, we'll come up back to the calculator But if you're looking in the article, you'll actually see that the average annual PMI premium is heavily dictated by the credit score that you bring to the application. For example, if you have a credit score of 620 to 639, your PMI payment is going to be about 1.5% of the loan. But if you go all the way up to 760 and above, the PMI payment that you make is 0.46% of your home loan on average. So if we go up to our PMI calculator, I want to show you an example of what that means. Let's say that this person is buying a $500,000 home, and instead of putting a 20% down payment, which would mean giving your lender $100,000 as a down payment, they decide instead to do a 10% down payment for $50,000, and at a 7% interest rate, they're going to have PMI added onto their home loan. We're also going to assume that they have an excellent credit score of 760 or above, and they're going to have a 30-year loan term. Now, with an average PMI payment of 0.46% of the loan, that means their monthly PMI payment until they've reached that 20% equity is $173 per month, and they're going to have to pay that for 8.34 years, and in that period, they're going to pay $17,274 in PMI payments. Now, here's my question. I can acknowledge that there are plenty of situations where if you have plenty of money to put as a down payment, you should avoid paying an extra $17,000 over the course of an 8-year period. But can you at least acknowledge that if a person is looking at the possibility of giving their lender $100,000 or being able to keep $50,000 in their own reserves, they would be able to use those extra funds to do things like replenish their emergency reserves, make home upgrades and renovations, fund a business like the business that I run on my day-to-day basis, have that money to invest over the course of time, and even though it may cost them $17,000 over 8 years, you do not know what the increase of being able to keep that $50,000 in your pocket will do by having the opportunity to disperse it amongst other goals and resources. So the first thing that we do that doesn't make sense on paper is we decided, even though we had the ability to avoid PMI, to instead do a lower down payment intentionally so that we could keep that money on the sidelines for other financial goals. The next thing I do that may not make as much sense on paper is I buy life insurance that's based on much more than the 10 times your income you might have seen from popular sources of financial literacy. Now, you'll see a lot of popular financial pundits who are trying to get you to save as much money on life insurance as possible. So they'll say, oh, just make sure you get a policy that's 10 times your income. So let's say, for example, that your income is $100,000. They would recommend you getting $1 million life insurance policy. And they would likely recommend that that would be a term policy, which covers you if you die within a certain term of time. That term could be 10, 15, 20, or 30 years. But when I look at 10 times my income, let's say the person who makes that $100,000 gets $1 million policy, there's so many things that aren't considered when you do that 10 times. It doesn't consider inflation. It doesn't cover any debts that may need to be paid off or you want to be paid off upon your death. It doesn't cover your cost of burial. But most of all, it doesn't cover the fact that over the course of the next 10 years, I plan to significantly increase my income. And I certainly plan to do so over the next 10, 20, or 30 years. So when I'm calculating my life insurance needs, I often go to 20 or 30 times my income, because the younger you are when you buy life insurance and the better health you are when you purchase it, the more it will save you over time. So that if I'm planning to increase my income over the next 20 years, 20 years from now, when I'm making more, I will have already baked in the cost that it takes to protect that income at a lower price than if I waited until I earned it to prepare for that expense. So the philosophy that I've had since I was in my 20s and starting in this profession was buy as much life insurance as you can as early as you can, because over the course of time, just like fixing your housing costs, where 20 and 30 years down the line, that mortgage is no longer as big of an expense, a life insurance premium that was a big deal to me when I was 25 is much less of a big deal when I'm 35, but I don't have to continuously replace my coverages because I'm earning more. And now that I'm earning more, I'm also older, presumably in worse health, and waiting will have cost me much more than paying a little more than I wanted to on the front end. The third may seem like a bit of a contradiction, especially because I just mentioned college costs in the previous example. But the third thing I do that on paper may not make much sense to some people is at this point in time, my wife and I have decided against planning for my son's college in terms of what we contribute to on a monthly basis. We will, over the course of time, talk more about 529s and UGMA's and all the different college planning things that you can do in terms of how you prepare for your children's college expenses. I also am of the opinion that just like what I talked about with 401k contributions and making sure that you are thinking of everything as if it's connected, that I want to make sure that every dollar that we're putting aside right now has the most utility. I am simultaneously with my wife trying to educate a child in the best way we know how, while also growing a business, while also putting ourselves in position to acquire more assets and preparing ourselves financially so that if our son decides to go to college, we'll be in the best position possible to help him cash flow that expense. So when I look at the odds of us being able to put money in a 529 to pay for his schooling, they are slim. If I look at the possibility that he will get to school and need some level of support from us, those odds are high. And when I think about those odds, my philosophy is that I want our finances to be in the best shape possible by the time he gets to school, so that when he gets to school, we both have the ability to help him cash flow it, but can also do so without compromising our financial future as well. Because I can tell you there is no worse scenario to be in than when you both don't have the ability to help cash flow your kids' college and you have sacrificed your future finances so that if there's anything you want to do for them after school, you're unable to be of any assistance. So at this point in time, maybe we'll change it in the future. We're focusing our efforts on putting dollars in places where we can use it for any reason, as opposed to a 529, which can only be used for specific uses. After the break, I'll tell you three more things I do that may seem illogical, and we will bring this thing on home.
This is the New Money, New Problems podcast, a show for successful professionals searching for the tools they need to navigate financial opportunities and obstacles they've never seen. We'll be right back.
Are you wondering what new money problems you might be overlooking in your financial life? If so, we've got great news. We've crafted the New Money New Problems Gap Finder to identify potential weaknesses in your finances in areas ranging from budgeting, investments, insurance, and even the threat your extended family's finances could pose to your household. Please head to newmoneynewproblems.com/gapfinder to complete it today. Again, that's newmoneynewproblems.com/gapfinder to take the assessment.
You're listening to the New Money, New Problems podcast. Subscribe now at newmoneynewproblems.com. Welcome back.
The fourth financial decision that we've made as a household is right now we have decided against pursuing any side hustles that do not increase the value and the profitability of our main hustle. And when I think of side hustles and I think of people who say that they're pursuing passive income, they are typically pursuing things like rental real estate or buying another business and, you know, kind of shadow operating it or putting people in place to operate that business. I think about people who do short-term real estate, people who do Uber Eats or drive for Lyft or do DoorDash. And I am not anti all of those things. As a matter of fact, I had a really unique conversation with a couple friends of mine yesterday who do DoorDash as literally something they do for date night. Like when they're going to explore a city, one of the things that they do is they just hop on their DoorDash account, get in their car, drive around, look at some neighborhoods, do it for a couple of hours, and then go treat themselves to a nice dinner with the money that they've earned. One of the more unique things that I've seen done as a side hustle. But I also come across people who are pursuing side hustles and putting so much time to them that they don't realize that in most cases, anything that you're pursuing that is trying to be passive income takes active hours to set up and contribute to before it becomes passive income. I do not know many real estate investors who have passive income that did not spend the majority of the time when they were pursuing those properties, putting in a lot of hours, a lot of grunt work, and a lot of manpower to put them in the position where they were eventually passive income. And even though I am pro side hustle, when you have an industry that you're in that has the ability to multiply itself in terms of profitability, like being an accountant, like being a realtor, like being a financial advisor, like being a mental health practitioner, in my opinion, every hour that you spend away from your main thing is an hour that you don't have the opportunity to actually make it more likely that you get that 2x, 10x multiple of your earnings. Now, if you're in an industry where the salaries are somewhat slotted, maybe you're an educator, maybe you are a professor, and you're not likely to be in a scenario where your income can go up 25%, 50%, 75%, 200%, then to me, a side hustle for you may be completely appropriate. But for my wife and I, my wife is in an industry where she does have the ability through pay raises or promotions to see a 25%, 50% increase in pay. And I'm in an industry where we do have the same ability to have a decrease in pay, but we have the option based on profitability, based on efficiency, to see that 2x, 3x multiple. While in the past, I pursued things like rental real estate and the like, I've decided that for this period in life, any hour that I spend needs to be either on the main thing or it needs to be on something that makes the main thing more profitable. You're probably thinking now, if you listen to our Escape Student Loan Debt podcast, Escape Student Loan Debt isn't financial advising. And Escape Student Loan Debt is separate from this business, but it is about something that impacts people who also work with new money, new problems. So by establishing a voice and a presence in that level of specialty, like with federal and private student loans, it attracts more people to my collective brand in a way that, in my opinion, makes the main thing more profitable. The fifth thing I do that may not make the most sense financially all the time is spending money on experiences now. I have shared with you all that I've had family members who have planned for years to travel when they retire or do certain things at a certain point in time only to have a health challenge or in some cases, unfortunately, have passed on without being able to pursue some of these things. I also come across movements like the FIRE movement, and I think that's a wonderful movement when done appropriately. But there's also extremes of any financial methodology, and there are some extremes of the movements where you're talking about this radical over-optimization of a person's finances to the point that they don't give themselves the ability or the freedom to enjoy any of that money now. But what I have said and tried to articulate in the past is that the difference between a person who is in the FIRE movement and only working on their finances and a person like myself or any financial advisor who gets to see the finances of dozens, if not hundreds of people is seeing how things play out. Because if you work with other people's finances, you have seen what I've seen, like the people I've described, where they plan for something for 30 years that never comes to fruition. And if you had seen that, you would have some appreciation for the fact that we are not guaranteed to make it to that 25 years, 30 years down the line, or even 10 years down the line, and being able to wait to experience those things then. So are there some years where we've done that and some financial things have come up where it wasn't the ideal time to travel? Absolutely. Are there some years where those expenses have risen to the point where we haven't been able to go anywhere at all? For sure, because we are trying to be responsible. But when we have the capacity, even when it's a little bit of a stretch, we try to make sure that we set aside time and money to enjoy the experiences that we can actually enjoy while we have the ability to do so. And the last thing that I do that may not always make sense, but it's something that I've decided to do is a commitment to myself. And it has to do with why we did this episode today. It is July 5th, as I said. I can't think of anybody that's working today. But instead of doing a replay episode, I, when I started this podcast, as I've shared, made a commitment to myself and to the audience that I was going to do 2 years of episodes every single week with no replay episodes before I decide whether this is something that's worth doing. Now, I've already decided this is something we're going to continue to do because we've been fortunate enough to have a number of opportunities that have popped up from some of the content we've created since we started this podcast. But I can also tell you, if you go look at our YouTube channel, that we had done over 100 videos before we even started the podcast with not much success in terms of what it did for our business prospects or the number of people who came into the door. But when I start something and I'm trying to evaluate whether it's worth doing, I first set a minimum amount of work that I'm going to do towards it before I start to evaluate whether it's worth it to continue. Because if you start something and you say, oh, after five episodes, I'm going to see if it's working, you could really walk away from something that's valuable to do because you didn't give it enough time to manifest itself. And we're going to share in future episodes why I think it is so important in this day and age to put yourself in front of a camera, put yourself behind a microphone, whether you work for yourself, work for someone else, and start to develop a digital presence and develop a digital expertise where you have a following of people, no matter how big or how small, that respect what you're putting out into the world. And this is a part of that for me and for our firm. So when I was looking last night and saying, you know, I didn't manage this week the way that I wanted to. I don't think people are going to be listening to the episode tomorrow anyways. I might as well just do a replay. I brought myself back to that commitment to always make sure we're putting out consistent content on financial literacy, because even if three people listen to it, that's three people who wouldn't have heard the episode, who had the opportunity to have some knowledge that we gave as a firm, and you never know who's in that three people. So I wanted to make sure I honored that commitment. Wanted to make sure that if you are listening today on July 5th, or whether you hear it next week, which is just fine, that you have something in your life and in your profession where you're making that commitment to yourself, regardless of whether you see the fruits of that labor right now. So if you are listening, I hope that you enjoyed this episode. We will be back for an episode that will release at the usual time of Friday at 5 a.m. Central Time next week. And I hope you all are tuned in then.
From New Money, New Problems, this was the New Money, New Problems podcast, a show for successful professionals searching for the tools they need to navigate financial opportunities and obstacles they've never seen.